Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. Part 2, The Yoga of Integral Knowledge, Chapter 9, The Release from the Ego, page 356. The formation of a mental and vital ego tied to the body sense was the first great labor of the cosmic life in its progressive evolution. For this was the means it found for creating out of matter a conscious individual. The dissolution of this limiting ego is the one condition, the necessary means for this very same life to arrive at its divine fruition. For only so can the conscious individual find either his transcendent self or his true person. This double movement is usually represented as a fall and a redemption, or a creation and a destruction, the kindling of a light and its extinction, or the formation first of a smaller temporary and unreal self, and a release from it into our true self's eternal largeness. For human thought falls apart towards two opposite extremes. One, mundane and pragmatic, regards the fulfillment and satisfaction of the mental, vital, and physical ego sense, individual or collective, as the object of life, and looks no farther, while the other, spiritual, philosophic, or religious, regards the conquest of the ego in the interest of the soul, spirit, or whatever be the ultimate entity, as the one thing supremely worth doing. Even in the camp of the ego, there are two divergent attitudes, which divide the mundane or materialist theory of the universe. One tendency of this thought regards the mental ego as a creation of our mentality, which will be dissolved with the dissolution of mind by the death of the body. The one abiding truth is eternal nature working in the race, this or another, and her purpose should be followed, not ours. The fulfillment of the race, the collective ego, and not that of the individual, should be the rule of life. Another trend of thought, more vitalistic in its tendencies, fixes on the conscious ego as the supreme achievement of nature, no matter how transitory, ennobles it into a human representative of the will to be, and holds up its greatness and satisfaction as the highest aim of our existence. In the more numerous systems that take their stand on some kind of religious thought or spiritual discipline, there is a corresponding divergence. The Buddhist denies the existence of a real self or ego, admits no universal or transcendent being. The Advaitin declares the apparently individual soul to be none other than the Supreme Self and Brahman, its individuality an illusion. The putting off of individual existence is the only true release. Other systems assert, in flat contradiction of this view, the eternal persistence of the human soul, a basis of multiple consciousness in the one, or else a dependent but still separate entity. It is constant, real, imperishable. Amidst these various and conflicting opinions, the seeker of the truth has to decide for himself which shall be for him the knowledge. But if our aim is a spiritual release or a spiritual fulfillment, then the exceeding of this little mold of ego is imperative. In human egoism and its satisfaction, there can be no divine culmination and deliverance. A certain purification from egoism is the condition, even of ethical progress and elevation, for social good and perfection. Much more is it indispensable for inner peace, purity, and joy, but a much more radical deliverance, not only from egoism, but from ego idea and ego sense, is needed if our aim is to raise human into divine nature. Experience shows that in proportion as we deliver ourselves from the limiting mental and vital ego, we command a wider life, a larger existence, a higher consciousness, a happier soul state, even a greater knowledge, power, and scope. Even the aim which the most mundane philosophy pursues, the fulfillment, perfection, satisfaction of the individual, is best assured not by satisfying the narrow ego, but by finding freedom in a higher and larger self. There is no happiness in smallness of the being, says the scripture. It is with the large being that happiness comes. The ego is, by its nature, a smallness of being. It brings contraction of the consciousness, and with the contraction, limitation of knowledge, disabling ignorance, confinement, and a diminution of power, and by that diminution, incapacity and weakness. Scission of oneness. And by that scission, disharmony and failure of sympathy and love and understanding. Inhibition or fragmentation of delight of being. And by that fragmentation, pain and sorrow. To recover what is lost, we must break out of the walls of ego. The ego must either disappear in impersonality or fuse into a larger I. It must fuse into the wider cosmic I, which comprehends all these smaller selves, or the transcendent of which even the cosmic self is a diminished image. But this cosmic self is spiritual in essence and in experience. It must not be confused with the collective existence, with any group soul, or the life and body of a human society, or even of all mankind. The subordination of the ego to the progress and happiness of the human race is now a governing idea in the world's thought and ethics. But this is a mental and moral, and not a spiritual ideal. For that, progress is a series of constant mental, vital, and physical vicissitudes. It has no firm spiritual content and offers no sure standing ground to the soul of man. The consciousness of collective humanity is only a larger comprehensive addition or a sum of individual egos. Made of the same substance, in the same mold of nature, it has not in it any greater light, any more eternal sense of itself, any purer source of peace, joy, and deliverance. It is rather even more tortured, troubled, and obscured, certainly more vague, confused, and unprogressive. The individual is, in this respect, greater than the mass, and cannot be called on to subordinate his more luminous possibilities to this darker entity. If light, peace, deliverance, a better state of existence are to come, they must descend into the soul from something wider than the individual, but also from something higher than the collective ego. Altruism, philanthropy, the service of mankind are in themselves mental, or moral ideals, not laws of the spiritual life. If into the spiritual aim there enters the impulse to deny the personal self or to serve humanity or the world at large, it comes not from the ego nor from the collective sense of the race, but from something more occult and profound, transcendent of both these things, for it is founded on a sense of the divine in all. And it works not for the sake of the ego or the race, but for the sake of the divine and its purpose in the person or group or collective. It is this transcendent source which we must seek and serve, this vaster being and consciousness to which the race and the individual are minor terms of its existence. There is indeed a truth behind the pragmatic impulse which an exclusive one-sided spirituality is apt to ignore or deny or belittle. It is this that, since the individual and the universal are terms of that higher and vaster being, their fulfillment must have some real place in the supreme existence. There must be behind them some high purpose in the supreme wisdom and knowledge, some eternal strain in the supreme delight. They cannot have been, they were not, created in vain. But the perfection and satisfaction of humanity, like the perfection and satisfaction of the individual, can only be securely compassed and founded on a more eternal yet unseized truth and right of things. Minor terms of some greater existence, they can fulfill themselves only when that of which they are the terms is known and possessed. The greatest service to humanity, the surest foundation for its true progress, happiness, and perfection, is to prepare or find the way by which the individual and the collective man can transcend the ego and live in its true self, no longer bound to ignorance, incapacity, disharmony, and sorrow. It is by the pursuit of the eternal, and not by living bound in the slow collective evolution of nature, that we can best assure even that evolutionary, collective, altruistic aim our modern thought and idealism have set before us. But it is in itself a secondary aim to find, know, and possess the divine existence, consciousness, and nature. And to live in it, for the divine, is our true aim, and the one perfection to which we must aspire. It is then, in the way of the spiritual philosophies and religions, not in that of any earthbound materialistic doctrine, that the seeker of the highest knowledge has to walk, even if with enriched aims and a more comprehensive spiritual purpose. But how far has he to proceed in the elimination of the ego? In the ancient way of knowledge, we arrive at the elimination of the ego sense, which attaches itself to the body, to the life, to the mind, and says of all or any of them, "This is I." Not only do we, as in the way of works, get rid of the I of the worker, and see the Lord alone as the true source of all works and sanction of works, and his executive nature power, or else his supreme Shakti, as the sole agent and worker. But we get rid also of the ego sense, which mistakes the instruments, or the expressions of our being, for our true self and spirit. But even if all this has been done, something remains still. There remains a substratum of all these, a general sense of the separate I. This substratum ego is something vague, indefinable, elusive. It does not or need not attach itself to anything in particular as the self. It does not identify itself with anything collective. It is a sort of fundamental form or power of the mind, which compels the mental being to feel himself as a perhaps indefinable, but still, a limited being, which is not mind, life, or body, but under which their activities proceed in nature. The others were a qualified ego idea and ego sense supporting themselves on the play of the prakriti. But this is the pure fundamental ego power, supporting itself on the consciousness of the mental Purusha. And because it seems to be above or behind the play and not in it, because it does not say, I am the mind, life, or body, but I am a being on whom the action of mind, life, and body depends, many think themselves released, and mistake this elusive ego for the one, the divine, the true Purusha, or at the very least for the true person within them, mistaking the indefinable for the infinite. But so long as this fundamental ego sense remains, there is no absolute release. The egoistic life, even if diminished in force and intensity, can still continue well enough with this support. If there is the error in identification, the ego life may, under that pretext, get rather an exaggerated intensity and force. Even if there is no such error, the ego life may be wider, purer, more flexible, and release may be now much easier to attain and nearer to accomplishment. But still, there is as yet no definitive release. It is imperative to go farther, to get rid of this indefinable but fundamental ego sense also, and get back to the Purusha, on whom it is supporting itself, of whom it is a shadow. The shadow has to disappear, and by its disappearance, reveal the spirit's unclouded substance. That substance is the self of the man called in European thought the monad, in Indian philosophy, jiva or jivatman, the living entity, the self of the living creature. This jiva is not the mental ego sense constructed by the workings of nature for her temporary purpose. It is not a thing bound, as the mental being, the vital, the physical are bound, by her habits, laws, or processes. The jiva is a spirit and self, superior to nature. It is true that it consents to her acts, reflects her moods, and upholds the triple medium of mind, life, and body, through which she casts them upon the soul's consciousness. But it is itself a living reflection, or a soul form, or a self-creation of the spirit, universal and transcendent. The one spirit who has mirrored some of his modes of being in the world and in the soul is multiple in the jiva. That spirit is the very self of ourself, the one and the highest, the supreme we have to realize, the infinite existence into which we have to enter. And so far, the teachers walk in company, all agreeing that this is the supreme object of knowledge, of works, and of devotion. All agreeing that if it is to be attained, the jiva must release himself from the ego sense, which belongs to the lower nature, or maya. But here they part company, and each goes his own way. The monist fixes his feet on the path of an exclusive knowledge and sets for us as sole ideal an entire return, loss, immersion, or extinction of the jiva in the supreme. The dualist, or the partial monist, turns to the path of devotion and directs us to shed indeed the lower ego in material life, but to see as the highest destiny of the spirit of man not the self-annihilation of the Buddhist, not the self-immersion of the Advaitin, not a swallowing up of the many by the one, but an eternal existence absorbed in the thought, love, and enjoyment of the Supreme, the One, the All-Lover.